Many of us cross a bridge of some sort every day, on the subway over the Williamsburg Bridge, walking on the Brooklyn Bridge, driving across the Tappan Zee. If you've ever wondered how that bridge was built or how safe it really is, you're in luck, because today's Please Explain is all about bridges. With me now are Dr. Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University, and the author of several books, including Engineers of Dreams, A History of America's Great Bridges. He's been a guest on our show before. Also here is Khalid Mahmoud, a bridge engineer with over 20 years' experience. He's the president of a firm called Bridge Technology Consulting, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.
How many different kinds of bridges are there?
Well, we have different kinds of bridges. We have cantilever truss bridges, such as the Queensboro. We have, of course, suspension bridges, such as the Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Williamsburg. And we have regular overpasses, steel girder bridges. And, of course, we have the magnificent type of bridge of the arch type, such as the Alexander Hamilton Bridge up on the the northern part of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And many other small crossings.
Anything that crosses, does it have to be a body of water? Can be called a bridge, whether it's a footbridge over a tiny garden pond or something big like the George Washington?
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to be a waterway. We have a lot of overpasses.
And they're called bridges?
And they are called bridges. So sometimes they are called overpasses, like over a highway or a street, and we still call them bridges. Structurally speaking, we call them bridges because that's the way we design them and that's the way we construct them.
What about elevated subways, the elevated trains? Aren't they really bridges?
Still call them bridges, believe it or not. We call them railroad bridges or bridges carrying railroad.
Henry, do you know how long humans have been building bridges?
Well, I imagine they've been building them as long as there has been civilization. Some of the early bridges would have been very primitive, of course. They might have been even something like stepping stones would really serve the purpose of a bridge, namely, you know, to get someone across, say, a stream without getting wet. A log over a stream would also be a primitive bridge. There are just all kinds of ways to cross water. I would say that not all bridges do have to go over water, as we've heard. There are some very spectacular bridges that go over very wide, deep valleys. These are often called viaducts, and there was a new one opened in France just recently that people like me can't wait to get to see.
Well, many of those old bridges, even when they got sophisticated, were of the sort where they were a couple of ropes were thrown across a space, and then I guess they were filled in. I don't know about pontoon bridges, but when did we start getting into serious bridge making? Was that the Romans who started doing that?
Well, it often dates from the Romans, yeah, because the Romans really seemed to raise it to an art. They had a memory of how their bridges failed and how they worked, and they evolved their bridges into the familiar Roman arch form, the circular arch.
And that's because they came up with the idea of the keystone?
Well, the keystone, I would say, is essential to it, but I would say first was the idea of an arch itself. And there are cases where arches occur in nature. They're sometimes called natural bridges. So it's not clear whether the keystone was necessarily the key to, you know, getting the arch.
Khalid, when you started studying making bridges, did you begin at the beginning or did you go right into the big stuff, the suspension bridges and the like?
Well, actually, the start was working on simple short span bridges, and then got fascinated by the suspension bridges and the concept of spanning the East River, for instance. If you were in the shoes of Jean Roebling when he was a young man, when he came to this country and start looking into the prospects of spanning the East River, and a project that he conceived, designed, and unfortunately did not survive to see it. He died in a freak accident at the bridge site sadly, 3 days after the approval of his magnificent span. But the history of things is the history of bridge building, and the fascination about suspension bridges is what drawn me to these magnificent structures.
How do suspension bridges work?
Well, a suspension bridge is basically supported in the end by the suspension cables. If you can imagine that everything on the bridge deck, the own weight of the structure and the traveling vehicles are all hung by the suspender ropes that deliver the load to the cables, and the cables in turn deliver their load to the towers and the anchorage.
So these towers are built, and then they hang cables from it, and then they attach that to the roadway.
Yeah, that's very much true. The towers are raised up, the anchorage, and then the suspension bridge wires are spun, for instance, from the towers all the way to the anchorage, and then the suspender ropes are erected, and then the bridge deck is hung from the suspender ropes.
Henry, how old is this concept? Do we know?
Well, the modern suspension bridge, the one we just heard described, dates from the late 18th, early 19th century, when they started using iron. The early suspension bridges didn't necessarily have cables, but they had iron chains that served the same function. The spans were shorter. It was preceded by what you described earlier, throwing a vine or a rope across a chasm. So the concept of suspension bridges is quite old. But the modern suspension bridge we would have to date from the use of iron as opposed to fibers, rope, and so forth that had less of a life.
Now, the Romans built their bridges in stone, so they lasted. The ones that were done in rope, of course, have all disappeared, so we have no idea of who started doing these things.
That's right. The Romans also built timber bridges, but, of course, they don't survive. That's the advantage of stone and also of steel. Of course, there are bridges that have lasted two centuries now that were made of iron and later of steel.
Hannibal, when he was moving on Rome, built, if I remember correctly, or was it Caesar? Julius Caesar built bridges across, into Gaul, and then took them up when he left so that he couldn't be followed.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting idea. It probably would have worked with the Williamsburg Bridge, and we wouldn't have had all this trouble recently. Are there limitations with suspension bridges? Can they cover long spans?
Well, of course they can cover long spans. That's the basic concept behind building suspension bridges, is the long span capability and driving the edge on that. But we have to be extremely cautious when we do that, because aerodynamics is the pivot of focus here, or the focus of the design of a suspension bridge. And, of course, we learned that lesson the hard way on November 7 of 1940 with the demise and the collapse of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. It was a 2,800 feet main span, and it was pushing the edge back then without providing the stiffening elements. It was only 8-foot deep girder that was serving as a stiffening element for the structure, a lesson that unfortunately we didn't back then as an engineering community learned from the demise of the Wheeling Bridge in 1854, that was also designed without a stiffening truss, a concept that Roebling has preached and professed all throughout, and we owe him a lot for that kind of teachings.
Well, Roebling figured it out, and yet the Tacoma Narrows Bridge didn't.
And there was a lesson forgotten, Leonard.
So how many calculations go into designing a bridge? You really do have to think about what kind of weight is going to be put on it for a very long time, don't you?
Indeed, because voluminous calculations go through we go through as engineers to verify and calibrate and yet check everything we do before we put it out for construction. Actually, something that emerged from the wreck of the Tacoma Narrows was the concept of aerodynamics. I think as a concept, it was almost born on that day, and we now have have it almost a standard, I would say, for any long span structure to have wind tunneling test that we have a model of the bridge tested in the laboratory before it's built.
We sometimes we have problems on the Tappan Zee because the cars and trucks are exposed, and when winds come whipping across it, they sometimes are turned over.
Yes.
Isn't that something also that the designer of the Tappan Zee should have considered?
I wouldn't say it was not considered. There are always limitations, and even when you hear the weather report at a certain wind speed, there will be a warning to limit the speed of vehicles. So this kind of combination can provide the safety instructions for motorists to consider when they cross the bridge.
Henry, isn't it true, maybe I think you might know about this, that the Tappan Zee was originally designed to just last 50 years?
Well, that might have been its design life.
It was built during the Korean War, and people didn't think it was going to last much longer. We also have the Williamsburg Bridge here that seemed to be designed not to last all that long. Why would they design a bridge with that in mind?
Well, for economics, the longer you design a bridge to last, the more expensive it costs. And you know, as we all know, when you're trying to design something and build something, you like to get it on the cheap very often.
But then you wind up paying in the future with the Williamsburg Bridge because they didn't use materials that would last. I guess everything rusted. They had to just take it totally apart and replace everything.
We should really understand that when we build some of these large monumental structures, that the capital investment, the so-called price of the structure, is really only part of it. There is that maintenance, and maintenance should be figured at 4 or 5, maybe even 6% a year. And if we're talking about, you know, a 50 or 100-year structure, we're talking about ultimately the maintenance cost really far outpacing the original cost of the bridge. This really can't be forgotten.
So when you're designing a bridge, Khaled, what materials do you use today? Would they be pretty much the same sorts of materials that would have gone into the Brooklyn Bridge?
Well, when it comes to the bridge wire, we are not that far from the bridge wire that was used back then, with certain enhancements, of course, with the material properties. And we are always trying to enhance the properties and the longevity of these wires. And what you mentioned earlier about the material and the rust, it is a matter of degradation. That's a process that takes place with any structure, like it takes place with us human. But with proper maintenance, we can extend the life of many of the beautiful structures we have around, and that is the case actually with the gigastructures we have, such as the Brooklyn Bridge and the Williamsburg Bridge.
How much does the terrain where the bridge is being built affect its design? Some places have muddier soil, clay, pebbles. There's salinity in the water. There's a lot of wind. Other places are mountainous. Is that all a factor?
Of course. All these factors are considered when we design a bridge. If we have rock, that could be very conducive to a very economical foundation for the bridge. If we have mud, if we have silt, that would be a different consideration that would determine also the span of the bridge and how much weight we can put on the bridge and how far down we can drive the pile foundations, for instance.
Henry, when a bridge is being designed in China, let's say, or in Brazil, is it going to be pretty much the same sort of bridge that would be designed for the United States?
Well, structurally, the fundamental structural principles are the same. They're universal. But there are cultural differences. The aesthetics of the bridge, let's say, or what might be called the architectural treatments, would certainly be different. Bridges built in the Far East look like they belong in the Far East, as they should, as bridges built in, you know, our country should look like they belong here. So there are those. They're more superficial differences, I would say, than any underlying engineering differences.
When I had Santiago Calatrava here, he told me that bridges were the most exciting things to design.
I agree with Santiago 100%.
Why is that? Because you have to consider so many things?
It is the concept of bridging gaps is fascinating. Filling a gap is almost placing the final component of beauty, especially when you design a structure that has the visual delicacy of the Brooklyn Bridge, for instance. Can you imagine the East River without the Brooklyn Bridge? I cannot.
Well, what interests me is that they built the Brooklyn Bridge, that gorgeous bridge, and then came up with the Manhattan, less gorgeous, and then the Williamsburg, not gorgeous at all.
Well, actually, we have to be fair to Nichols and Moiseev when it comes to the Manhattan Bridge and Buck at the Williamsburg Bridge, because there were limitations on the budget for Buck and limitations on the budget and time. And I actually happen to think that the Manhattan Bridge is not that bad looking at all.
Well, maybe if it had been completed, the entryway has never really been finished, has it?
Well, that's true.
Most bridges, I'm assuming, are designed to support thousands of cars. I don't know how many tons a bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge or any of the others, has to withstand at any given moment, but it must be an incredible amount.
Well, the greater job of a bridge structure is to support itself. The cars and the traffic on it are almost insignificant, generally speaking.
Really? Well, we'll come back to that and take some calls. Our number, by the way, is 212-433-9692. We're talking about bridges today on Please Explain. And my guests are Dr. Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University, and Khaled Mahmoud, a bridge engineer who is the president of a firm called Bridge Technology Consulting. Stay with us. And we're back with Khaled Mahmoud, a bridge engineer, and Henry Petrosky, a professor of civil engineering and history at Duke. And soon to take your calls at 212-433-9692. How long does it take to build a bridge, Henry?
Well, that depends. The Brooklyn Bridge took about 14 years. You look at what happened down in New Orleans with the bridge across Lake Pontchartrain that had a lot of its sections destroyed in the wind, that bridge was back in operation within weeks, literally. So it's a matter of will. But typically, we're talking for these large bridges, matters of years.
Mm-hmm. Did the Mohawks still do most of the steel work on bridges built in the East?
I would assume for the high tower work. I don't know that for a fact. I know they do work on buildings.
What is the greatest cost, Khaled? Materials, labor, or the design?
Well, I would say at this point in time it's the material and the technology we use. The labor is, of course, has its sizable cost, but the material and the construction technology that we use, especially when you talk about something like the Akashi-Kyoko Bridge, for instance, in Japan, or the...
Well, that's one of the longest bridges in the world?
That is the longest suspension bridge in the world, or yet the longest ever that yet to be built, the Messina Strait Bridge, which is going to almost exceed the current Akashi-Kyoko Bridge by more than... 50%.
Wow.
So, yeah, it will span 11,000 feet as a main span, which is spectacular.
We're talking about 11,000 feet, over 2 miles of bridge.
Indeed, and that's talking only about the main span between the two towers.
Well, these things cannot ever be privately financed, can they?
Well, actually, I think what's happening at Messina is the Italian government is placing a great weight behind the venture of building the Messina Strait.
In this country, bridges these days often are really more pork barrel projects than anything else. There's that bridge in Alaska that many people have been talking about. Is there any point in building a bridge that people won't use, or has history revealed, Henry, that if you build a bridge, people will come?
Yeah, it's like building a baseball field. They will come. Bridges do encourage development. I don't know the details of the Alaska situation, but, the city of Brooklyn was independent of the city of New York, Manhattan, before the Brooklyn Bridge was built. Within years of the Brooklyn Bridge's completion, Greater New York was formed with the five boroughs. The bridge itself promoted the communication between the formerly independent cities and led to their consolidation.
And because the Brooklyn Bridge is so beautiful, in the same way that the Golden Gate is so beautiful, it becomes a symbol, and then that attracts more people.
Indeed.
Without question.
In the case of the George Washington Bridge, I gathered there was supposed to be a marble skin, which doesn't seem very practical to me, and finances prevented that from happening. I can't imagine what that bridge would look like. It's so gorgeous as it is.
Well, most people do believe it's a very beautiful bridge in steel. But at the time when it was being designed and constructed in the 1920s, it was felt that for such a long, monumental bridge like that was to be, that its towers should be of stone or look like they were of stone, like the Brooklyn Bridge, because that was the model, that was the paradigm of the time. But as you say, the economics kept that from happening, and people began to realize that a bridge made of steel can be beautiful in its own right.
Let's take some calls. Mike from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you. And just a note about putting stone on bridges. I recently had the opportunity to go over the Hell's Gate Bridge, which is right near the Triborough. It's got these huge stone piers at either end of the large arch. And it turns out they're not functional. They're just there to make the bridge look good. But my question really has to do with computer modeling and aesthetics of bridge design. I recently saw the wonderful Santiago Calatrava exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he builds these tower bridges that look like birds in flight. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously better materials and computer modeling have helped. The Musief Bridge, the Tacoma Bridge, obviously fell down because they didn't have computer modeling. And as a result of that, I understand they added weight and took weight off, and they added weight and took weight off of the Bronx Whitestone Bridge because they weren't sure how to model it. So I wonder if your guests could talk a little bit about how aesthetics and computer modeling and new materials affect future bridge design, the Calatrava and some others. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for calling us.
Well, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge is an excellent example in which to discuss this question, because it was aesthetics that drove that bridge to look the way it did more than anything. And I wouldn't say that it was because there wasn't computer modeling that it collapsed. It collapsed because the wind, the dynamic effect of the wind, the moving wind, was simply not taken into account. Whether you have a computer model or not, if you don't put that question to it, you're missing a fundamental idea.
I agree with Henry. Actually, the weight of a suspension bridge can act again as the bridge itself. It is how you use the weight and how you distribute the weight and how you provide rigidity and stiffness of the suspension span is what's going to determine the service and the safe service life of the bridge or not. And in the case of the Tacoma, that was not taken into consideration, irrespective of the computer modeling being existing or not. And when it comes to the magnificent designs of Santiago Calatrava, of course, with what we know today about computer modeling and how to just model anything we want, it is, of course, a great advantage that we use to model bridges and to design the magnificent bridges we design today.
Thank you for your call. Andrew from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Yes, hi. I have a question on I think a caller had referred to it before, the Bronx Whitestone Bridge. I noticed that the zigzag columns that run alongside of it have been removed, and I heard somebody say that it was something about the weight of the bridge. You know anything about that?
Well, actually, you're referring to the stiffening trusses. The Bronx Whitestone Bridge, when it was open to traffic one day before the World Fair in 1939, was designed without the stiffening trusses. But after the collapse of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in November of 1940, there was fear that the Bronx Whitestone might be vulnerable to wind activities and due to fear of meeting the same fate of the Tacoma Narrows. The stiffening truss was designed and installed in 1946. Lo and behold, it was not a part of the original design, and actually after removing the stiffening truss and installing what's called the wind fairing on the bridge, it provided that sleek, nice look, original look of the bridge, and it is functioning quite well.
Thank you for your call. Richard from Syosset. Hi, you're on Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, how are you doing? I thought your guests might be interested to know that Theodore Burr, who was, I think, the brother of Aaron Burr, was a bridge designer. And in early 1800s, he designed and built a wooden suspension bridge across the Mohawk River in Schenectady. And instead of steel cables, they had wooden timbers for cables and wooden suspenders. And then the bridge was covered to protect it from the weather. The bridge lasted about 50 years.
That's great.
And that's all I had to say.
I understand you're an engineer yourself.
Yes, I am.
So do you design bridges?
Yes,
or do
I
you,
do.
You have anything to add to what we've been saying so far?
No, I just find it very interesting.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for calling us. Our number, by the way, is 212-433-9692. My guests are Henry Petrosky and Khalid Mahmood. And we're talking about bridges on Please Explain. Marcia from Long Branch, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I love bridges, and when I was in London, I especially loved the bridges across the Thames. And then many years later, I found myself in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, and I thought that it would be interesting to hear the history of how the London Bridge got transferred to Lake Havasu City. It's very peculiar.
Well, when bridges are torn down or decommissioned, as it's often said, they're often offered for sale. And the London Bridge was in that category. And somebody bought it, and had it transported over to Arizona. And
where there was no actual water for it to go over.
Right.
They actually had to make a lake for it.
Right.
Well, it was interesting because you said perhaps when you build a bridge, even if it isn't useful, it becomes useful, because now that bridge is very much traveled.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's attracted tourists, for one thing.
Well, they've built a little old
yeah.
London town all around it. It's very strange, but it's fun, and it's beautiful. It's
well,
still beautiful, even though it's shorter than it was originally. Am I correct?
I'm not sure about that.
But I'm interested in the fact that bridge was built a long time ago and works perfectly well. You go to Italy and you cross some of these bridges that have shops along the side, and realize that they go back 600-700 years, have been in use all that time. I'd imagine when they were designed, no one ever thought, oh, gee, people in the 21st century will be crossing the Po on this bridge.
But we have to, you're right, Leonard, but one factor to consider here is a bridge that we see today that lasted 600-700 years is what lasted, but it took them probably a lot of experimentation and a lot of trials and errors up until they got it right.
We saw some bridges destroyed in the former Yugoslavia as part of the civil war that happened there. How vulnerable are bridges to terrorist attacks?
Oh, quite vulnerable. That there was a time right after 9/11 when photography was prohibited on major bridges.
Although I think everybody knows everything about the Brooklyn Bridge by now. I've seen millions of photographs of it over the years.
Well, but there are still details of it as built, as opposed to, you know, how it was designed, how it was recorded in plans. And a current photograph shows degrees of corrosion, for example, that artistic photos might not find interesting. There are things that have been missed that would be of quite a lot of interest to a certain type of terrorist.
Are the really long bridges more vulnerable? For example, aren't they planning a bridge between Sicily and Calabria?
That's the Messina Strait Bridge
yeah.
that was mentioned earlier. That's right. So that would be a big issue, yes. Terrorism.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for participating in Please Explain today. I've been talking to Dr. Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University, author of several books, including Engineers of Dreams, A History of America's Great Bridges, and Khalid Mahmood, a bridge engineer for over 20 years. He's the president of a firm called Bridge Technology Consulting. What fun it's been.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.